Hey everybody, welcome again to Elmtown episode 11. We apologize for the hiatus that we've had of a few weeks. I had a new human being come to my house in the form of a baby, and I'm very happy, but it takes a lot of energy and time, so I've taken a little break from recording episodes. But we're back again today, and we're going to be talking about the history of signals with Evan, the creator of Elm. And first, I'd like to highlight our sponsors quickly. We've got in number one spot, Humble Spark, which is a development consultancy based in Chicago. And you've heard Luke on the show many times before. Luke is a member of Humble Spark, and they're a fantastic group that's contributing to Elm's community and just generally doing good in the world. They specialize in web and front end. They provide practical experience and expertise in development. They use modern tools, including Elm. I think they also do React, etc. So if you've got people you know who are looking for consulting help in Elm or other React-ish languages, then talk to them. They support the Elm community by doing podcasts, by doing open source projects, and other things. So they're a fantastic company. Please keep your eye on them and go to them if you need some help. There's Day One, the company that I work for, a beautiful journaling and life archiving app for Mac and iOS, coming soon to the web and coming soon to Android too. I'm working on the web client right now, and that's chiefly where I've been working with Elm. And it's a joy. I really enjoy doing that. And big thanks to them for sponsoring the podcast and letting me use my work time to contribute to the Elm community too, and to run the podcast. Last but not least, we have Daily Drip, which is a training service that makes keeping up to date on programming skills easier. Their whole thing is they send you snippets of learning information to your inbox. They'll send you a clip that's about 5 minutes long that you can learn something about Elm or Elixir or HTML and CSS. They have a number of topics. You can learn it in 5 minutes and level up your learning just a little bit every day, which is a great way to overall level up pretty fast. I've learned good things from these videos, and I think that you probably will too. So we have a special coupon code just for Elmtown listeners. If you go to the site, please sign up using the code Elmtown, all one word, all lowercase, and you'll save $9 on your first month, which means that you can try out the Elm topic for free. And if you use that coupon code, we get kudos, and then they want to keep sponsoring us. So I encourage you to do that if you haven't done it. And I'd like to acknowledge and give big thanks to Fergus, whose last name I will not try to pronounce at the moment, for editing and cutting the show every week. He's fantastic and offers that as his service to the community too, and we really appreciate it. And now, over to Evan. Evan, welcome again to the show. Thanks for coming to spend time with us.
Hi.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Is it early morning where you are right now?
Yeah, it's not bad.
It sounds beautiful, though. Beautiful California weather, I'm imagining.
Yeah, it's warming up.
I rode my bike to work today, and it was still a little bit cold, but it was fun. I wore my ski helmet and goggles. So
it's that optimistic phase where everyone's like, it's warm now, right?
That's right, yeah.
I'm just committed to that.
Warm enough just to go outside and get a cold because your coat's not quite thick enough. Yeah. Well, today we're going to be talking about the history of signals. Now, we're hoping that this kind of starts a new series in our podcast of the history of X, where we can kind of learn about how the language Elm came about and its parts. So in this spirit, we're going to start out talking about signals. And signals are an abstraction or a concept that used to be very important in the Elm language. It used to be that in order to be able to kind of use the Elm application architecture, you also had to understand these things called signals and mailboxes. But those were removed from the language entirely in version 0.17, if I remember correctly. So, Evan, why don't you kind of start at the beginning and tell us what first brought the use of signals about, why they were useful, and then why did you choose to remove them from the language?
Sure. So when I first started this project, it didn't have a name, and it was just this set of UI primitives. So what's now the Elm Graphics Library that is under my name on GitHub, that was everything. So you could make elements, and you could have these collages and place pentagons and triangles and squares. And that was kind of the whole vision of Elm at that point. I mean, before it was Elm, it was just like, man, I really would like to vertically and horizontally center something. What's a system that can do that?
The age-old desire of any web developer?
Yeah. So at that point, I had this set of graphics primitives that was basically a Haskell library that would spit out HTML. And it would have been like late 2011, right? So like before I started my thesis senior year of college, because I hadn't yet formulated like how the scope of the project that would have aligned with doing my thesis work on it.
Okay. So if I remember correctly, part of what gave you this idea, you were working at an internship, right? Is that correct at the time?
Well, that was where like the core motivation came from. That was actually a couple of years earlier, and it kind of like stewed. But yeah, I was working at Google, and my actual work was as a back-end intern. So I was doing C++ stuff, and it finished with some weeks left, and I helped a friend of mine who was also interning as a PM. And interning as a PM is difficult because you as an intern have to like lobby full-time employees to do what you say. And they're like, it wasn't so hard to lobby me to just be like, yeah, I'll just do it. I ended up working on front-end stuff in a professional environment that in theory should have been very pleasant. And I guess I was like shocked that in working on a 20-year-old language with like tooling developed over two decades that I couldn't vertically center things. But the more sort of egregious thing that I noticed then was we had like a navigation bar on the left side that was going to be on every single page, and there just wasn't a reuse mechanism for that. So the answer was like either don't or like use an iframe, or like there's this weird Google only templating language that you can learn. And I just was like, didn't someone think about this like 40 or 60 years ago? Like, so that was kind of where the core motivation got started, because I did a lot of graphic stuff before that with games, but I didn't do a lot of front end stuff. Sorry for the motorcycle. My neighborhood is exciting sometimes.
That's great. It's exciting. So was this, you said that you had done game stuff, but this was your first like experience with the frustration of front-end web development as a tool for UIs. Okay. So that's the motivation. And then we fast forward a couple years and you're at school. Yeah. Are you looking for a project to do for your senior thesis?
I wasn't looking for a project, really. I just was like, I got to fix this. This is really messed up. So, like, it was just kind of, like, that's what I was doing. I don't know. It wasn't in search of anything, necessarily. It was just like, oh, this is fun.
Was this a scratch-your-own-itch thing?
Like, yeah, for sure.
You weren't doing a whole lot of front-end stuff still, right? This was just, like, I see a problem and I want to solve it.
Yeah, and I mean, I was interested in visual stuff still. You know, I had done most of my game making in Java and didn't really feel excited about continuing on in that ecosystem. So at some point in working on this, you know, I get a Pentagon showing on screen. It's very exciting, you know. I show my family. I'm like, hey, Mom, check it out. It's a Pentagon. And, you know, she's like, yeah, it's what they look like. but there's something, I don't know, when you're making a system like this, when it starts working, that first moment, you sort of know everything else is going to work. So I had that excitement of like, oh, like I see where this is going. And, you know, my mom would see a Pentagon. So I had that working, and I was like, okay, well, that's neat. What if it rotated? Or what if it followed the mouse? Or all these kinds of things. And I was coming from a background where I sort of, you know, I wanted this to be in a typed functional language with immutable values and no mutation, all these kinds of things. And so I had a problem. Like, well, I want the Pentagon to move. There are ways to do that, but they're all imperative. So at some point I have this like flash of insight. What if the X and Y values just changed over time? So it's not that it was mutating, but just the value was changing based on something in the world. And for a couple of days, you know, I thought I had like revolutionized something. And I was like, so again, I was like, Mom, it's going to be great. That Pentagon you saw, it's going to rotate. It's going to be amazing. And she was like, you know, you should see if there's any, you know, prior work on this. Like, surely someone's thought of this idea.
Words of wisdom from Mom.
Yeah.
Love it.
So I end up doing that, and it turns out, you know, this particular idea, I was like 14 years late.
Yeah, what was the paper called?
I think it's called Functional Reactive Animation, was the very first paper that sort of very directly the same idea.
And do you remember the author?
It's Conal Elliott and Paul Hudak.
Okay. We'll see if we can get a... I don't know if that would be open for reading. Or
oh, for sure. Yeah. It's online. It's a really nice paper. Everything I read by Hudak is like really lovely to read.
Cool.
Yeah, so that, it's actually like a cool paper to start out with if you're new to reading that kind of stuff.
Sounds great. We'll see if we can link to that.
Cool. So yeah, so I found that, and that sort of... that intuition that I had, it was like, okay, it's clear that there's history for this. And so I already had a background in doing compiler stuff. When you want to go from some language that you like to JavaScript, and if you're just generating HTML, that's actually really straightforward because you can create these data structures and then the data structures can be converted to HTML. But if you want them to do stuff, you need to also generate JavaScript. So I wanted my Pentagon to rotate, so I needed at least a plus sign, right? And so I had a trilemma. I had a decision to make. So I had been doing this library in Haskell. So one option was figure out how to make GHCJS do what I wanted it to do, which wasn't necessary. So try to make libraries in Haskell and do all these kinds of things, and then I would spend a bunch of time figuring out how GHC works, figuring out how the JavaScript generation works, like the assets.
So GHCJS is a tool that compiles Haskell source code to JavaScript, right?
Yes, yeah, thank you. And so this was 2011, and my feeling was, like, I went and looked through the source code of that compiler, and some of the conventions in Elm actually come from how that compiler is written.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, for example, in the reverse way, so they have many sort of long files, and they do typical Haskell imports, which means like always open, exposing everything.
Yeah,
so you'd have like 30 imports of like serious, difficult stuff, and then like 1,000 lines where you're just like, I wonder what that is. I wonder what that is. I wonder what that is. And I'm like going through it in Emacs and just like, it was kind of crazy. And so I came out of being like, qualified names are like really important.
Okay, so this was I'm not going to be like that thing.
Right.
Experience.
Right.
Okay.
And I think I don't mean that to be a criticism of like that ecosystem. I think it's just like, as a compiler writer, sometimes your style doesn't match with the rest of the ecosystem, just because like in a lot of ways it precedes the creation of a lot of the customs of the community.
Makes sense.
I don't know how true that is in the Elm compiler. I try to like make it look Elmy, but so I looked through that and I kind of felt that the amount of time I'd spend just figuring out what is going on would be huge compared to if I were to work on something separately.
Yeah.
There also were, like, you know, at that time there were a bunch of different Haskell to JS compilers, and this one seemed to be the one that sort of could do the most, but the size of the assets it created was really huge. And okay, there was another weakness, which is when it gets more into signals and functional reactive programming, is that Haskell's lazy, which is kind of a point one, is like when you're in the browser, is that something that's really like a top priority? And My feeling was no. I mean, I don't think it's a top priority even in my Haskell code. Like, I've on many occasions found it to like seriously break my projects, and on like two occasions be useful. So,
okay. Do you think you can explain in like a couple words to those who don't know what it means to have a lazy versus an eagerly evaluated language, what that means?
Sure. So in Elm, when you say absolute value of 4 plus 5, you have to do the 4 plus 5 calculation before you call the next function. So essentially, it forces all your arguments to be evaluated before you call a function.
Okay.
In a lazy language, you delay evaluation until you need the value later. So if you never use this absolute value of 4 plus 5, you just would never compute any part of it. Now,
okay.
That's not free, right? So the way you do that, so if it just was a computation, you'd do 4 plus 5, that's now an integer. You do absolute value, that's an integer. And so the whole memory you use is an integer. Now, if it's lazy, you have a delayed, like essentially a function that takes zero arguments that can be called later. So you have a reference to that, you have the actual body of it, you have the data that's in there. And then when it's called, that takes time. And then it gives you another thunk, which is I have to do 4 plus 5. So you have this sort of memory cost that you pay for keeping these values around rather than evaluating them.
And so that function that you have that has takes no arguments and runs later, that's a thunk is what you said, right?
Yeah, I didn't use that term, but that is called a thunk, yes.
Cool. I think you used it in your second sentence,
okay.
So I wanted to clarify
okay,
that.
Okay, I messed up.
And we do, it's okay. I think we also follow that pattern in normal JavaScript with promises. You'll pass in a function that's evaluated later. So that's kind of a lazy approach.
Yeah.
Except for promises are eagerly evaluated, so.
Yeah, so.
Not to get off track, but okay, so that was a question you had was.
Yeah, so what is the interaction of this functional reactive programming style and laziness? So let's actually tackle that. So that ties into the choices I made around this more. So when you're doing this kind of programming where one of the good demos of using signals was there was a mouse library and you could say mouse.position, and that was a tuple of integers and it would just change as the mouse moved. And so if you define something in terms of mouse.position, it would just move. And so the way you would do this is you'd say that position is a signal, right? So a value that's changing over time. So think of like a signal, like a radio signal, or like a, well, but I'm thinking of like physical analogy. That's why I thought the name was nice. Like, you know how when they do stock tickers and you see the day's price over time? That kind of signal.
It's an abstraction that incorporates a value and the change of that value.
Yeah, so when you look at it, when you look at a signal, like a radio signal, like you know what it is right now, but it has this time component. So mouse position would change, and then you could use like signal.map and like apply a function to that, and it would then change over time. So if you wanted a pentagon that moved, you'd map, make a pentagon function over mouse position, and that would just like be how things work. And
that makes a lot of sense as to what a signal is. And did the functional reactive paper build itself on signals?
They're sort of exploring different designs. So they had a concept of behaviors and events. So a behavior was a continuous version of these things, and events were sort of discrete versions of these things. And so later work by Paul Hudak introduced the concept of a signal, which sort of unified those two for the sake of efficiency and simplicity, and I thought that was really nice. And that also, that approach sort of matched with what I don't know, just like it felt messy to have these two separate things, and I didn't really believe in the behaviors that they had. So they had this fully continuous idea where at any moment you can get the current time and it will sort of be recomputing all the time. And my feeling was like, that's not how computers really work. Like, they are these discrete moments where something changes. It's not really a continuous function that we're just integrating over.
Because it can't really be. It has to be a series of discrete events.
Yeah. So in my thesis, I call this like the instantaneous response assumption. I forget exactly what I call it. But essentially, part of what makes the semantics of these early papers work is this assumption that computation takes zero time. And so you really can get a perfect like integral of this change over time.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, for a lot of reasons, that'd be cool if computers worked that way. And so making that assumption sort of meant you could not really look at a bunch of topics, such as like what happens if something needs to be asynchronous. Like if it's an HTTP request, is there really a continuous model of how that works? And I was like, I don't think there is.
So you sounds like you spent a lot of time going through papers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was my thesis work. So there was a big literature review where I read basically all the papers that had been published on this topic at that time. And there had been a couple after that didn't make the cut. Or like just, I couldn't read them because they were in the future.
Surprise.
Hey, but interestingly, with function reactive programming, one of the early flaws was that you could ask for values from the future.
And time travel was invented.
Well, more that impossible to implement languages were invented. So a lot of the work was sort of how do we constrain these systems such that we can't refer to future values that depend on past value. Like we can make the current value depend on a future value, and therefore like our implementation just like has to like die.
That sounds like a lot of fun to read and to write a fiction novel about.
So I sort of went through all this literature. And so one of the things that I found interesting was that there's a decent amount of work that goes into sort of balancing laziness and state, right? So one of the primitives in Elm was called fold P. So in the way that on lists you have fold L, which is fold from the left, and fold R, which is fold from the right. And for folks out there who have a hard time remembering, I actually will usually hold up my left or right hand and move it across where the list will be, and I'll be like, ah, yes, that's a fold right, fold from the right. So fold P was fold from the past, which is, you know, you go to the past and then you fold over the values as they come in. And so this was our way of managing change over time. So if you folded over mouse position, you could build a list of all the positions you've ever been to.
And so you could build a static representation of the history of that thing.
Yeah.
So this is why with that Mario demo, there was this really cool Mario demo for Elm where you could make Mario jump around and see him leave a path. And then you could go back and adjust the parameters of gravity, for example. And you'd see his history adjust in reaction to those parameters.
We thought we needed signals for that. But it turns out all you need is like the history of the events. And if you have there are other ways to make that efficient to compute besides signals. But signals were a very nice way of making that efficient to compute. So a wrinkle comes in when you have this notion of state. So say instead we have a clock that is ticking every second. And you're in an app like Gmail that's going to be open all day long. And the time's not always visible. So in a lazy language, it's like, oh, great, I can just delay this computation until later when someone looks at it. The issue is doing a single addition of one every second is like very cheap, and like you probably should just do it. And with laziness, what you do instead is you say, well, I'm going to add one to whatever that is. And then later you say, well, I'm going to add one to whatever that is. And then I say, I'm going to add one to whatever that is. And it just keeps going all day long.
It's a huge memory cost.
Exactly. And let's say you can fit it all in memory. When it finally does come time to compute it, the computation itself is also, it's no longer constant, right? Like, you have to pay the cost of all of those things. So if it's 1,000 additions, you do them all at once. So you can actually get pauses when you're trying to compute that value all at once. So one of the root things that I thought was really important was when you're doing a UI, even if there's something you can delay until later, you probably don't want to, right? Like, all the work that I do on a drawer that's hidden right now, like on the backing values, I want to do them now, right? Like, I don't want, when the drawer opens and finally they show up on screen, I don't want the UI to like freeze up.
Right. Yeah. Makes total sense.
So that was one of the core motivations of like when choosing how this project was going to go, like, in terms of compiler, like, okay, so, you know, you can make these domain-specific languages, embedded domain-specific languages, and there's a nice paper by Hudak about EDSLs, he calls them, and how Haskell's a nice language for that kind of exploration. And ultimately, I was like, I'm going to have a nightmare getting GHCJS to work. It's going to be lazy. I'm going to be tied into all these design decisions that aren't necessarily right for graphical user interfaces, which is, I sort of frame this as, I want to make graphical user interfaces, and I want to do that in the browser, not I'm going to make JavaScript better. And I think that's actually a really important distinction.
Because then it's a declarative goal and not just an imperative, like...
Well,
I don't know my purpose, but I'm going to do this thing that makes it better.
Yeah, so it's more asking, like, what would it look like if we came to this problem in, like, a first principles way, as opposed to, given that we have JavaScript, how do we make it suck less?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I decided that creating my own compiler and language gave me a lot more freedom. So I knew I wanted a strict language for other reasons. Like, I had had personal struggles with laziness in my code, and I have since then have some cool examples of that. Like, in an early iteration of the type inference algorithm, it just took a lot of memory, and in one of the rewrites, and like, it was one of these lazy space leaks where something that should have been computed just was being delayed until later, and this was making things very, very costly and slow. And I just, like, ultimately I couldn't find it. I spent like 3 days trying to track down the source of this, and so ultimately I just, like, wrote it different and it went away.
Using a big hammer. That makes sense.
Yeah, and like, I felt that that wasn't an ideal experience.
Yeah.
And this will tie into my thesis at some point, but like, I also tried to do an implementation of signals in Haskell so I could do the concurrency part of my thesis. And the trick is, if you send lazy values between threads, like, the whole point of concurrency is you say, I want this work to happen over here and that work to happen over here, and they're independent, they can be interleaved, all these things. But if your values are lazy, the worker can just say, oh, I did the work in air quotes, and hands it off to someone else, and they actually end up having to evaluate it because it was just lazily wrapped up.
That makes sense.
So that's sort of some of the core motivation for making my own compiler. And also, I had this feeling that our design choices would diverge over time, right? So, like, I had a background in OCaml and standard ML. And, like, I see Haskell's choices as, like, their choices in contrast with, you know, the history going back to the 70s of ML languages. And it just didn't seem obvious to me that every single choice that Haskell made would be the right choice for UI.
Makes sense.
So, okay, so back to signals. This sort of was the core abstraction that was kind of simplifying how things would have gone in other languages, right? So had you done this in OCaml, you would have just used mutation. Had you done it in Haskell, they would have said, oh, use the IO monad and just, you'll just change things that way. But it'll be our way, so it's not, you know, it's no problem. It's the good kind of mutation. And so the idea was, like, you could get access to, like, mouse and keyboard in a way that was really direct and really sort of felt obvious once you got the logic of signals. And I think a lot of folks found that exciting, right? Like, oh, I just have the mouse position. I can use that in my program.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if we should focus on, like, the too much the choices Elm signals made in comparison to the academic literature, or just, like...
I think probably it would be most valuable to hear what the language learned from having signals and then why we don't have them anymore. Because I think a lot of people probably know about RxJS, the libraries from Netflix and others, and how there's all this really cool stuff you can do with signals as far as merging them and transforming them. And stuff.
Yeah, so the thing is, like, Elm was purposely way simpler than those kinds of libraries. So within all of this work, there was this tension between what some people called expressiveness, right? So, like, how crazy of stuff can I do with signals alone?
Like, are they Turing complete?
Well, more like, can I have a signal of signals, and then can I turn that into a signal? It was the essential question, or the essential difference. And so in Elm... yeah, I made the choice that you can't have signals of signals, because I personally felt it didn't really, I didn't really understand what it meant to, I have this infinite time series of infinite time series. And I was like, I just don't know how you come back from that.
Okay.
And so... earlier work in this discipline sort of did that in a way that sort of had semantics that made sense. And it required these sort of assumptions of everything happens instantaneously, or, you know, some work got into fancier type systems to just try to rule out weird programs where, like, if you have an infinite series of infinite time series of infinite time series and you merge them all together, like, how do you predict when these events are going to happen, and if they're defined in terms of, it just got kind of crazy. And so when you look at the JavaScript stuff, this is sort of totally divorced from the academic work in how everything works, really, but it has this, like, apparent similarity, but they also have the idea of signals of signals. In any case, we had a much simpler system where you have a signal, you can map over it, and you can use fold p. And that was kind of the extent of things. I mean, there was also map 2, which let you combine two signals. And there was merge, which, if you had a signal of clicks and a signal of key presses, you'd then end up with a single signal of both of those things.
Pretty cool stuff.
So that was the whole extent of our system. And we began to notice that programs were just written in a certain way. So when I did the first academic presentation of my thesis work, I did the presentation in Elm. So I actually created, like, the slides and the animations using signals and using the collage library. And just a note to anyone doing presentations like this, try to write your presentation first, like, on paper, and then program it. Because sometimes you'll just, like, lose hours being like, this animation is going to be so neat. And then you're like, wait a second, is this really the best way to talk about this?
But everyone's going to love it. They're going to be like, thesis defended. Boom.
So, yeah. Animation. So this was, there was, like, a pretty late night before. So this was actually at PLDI for the published paper that came out of this.
Okay.
So I was up pretty late, like, putting the final touches on it. And the next day I sort of looked through the code to see, like, how it came out. And it was, like, pretty fine, which didn't seem right. You know what I mean? Like, if you stay up late, like, just get it working. Like, it's rare that you come back and you're like, oh, this is actually... there's not much to refactor here.
Sure, yeah.
And so just the way, because we chose this very restricted form of signals, And that's a pattern you'll notice in Elm, is like, what is the simplest possible thing we can get away with? And what do we learn from living within those constraints? So in this case, I began to notice, like, well, I have a single fold P that I put my inputs into, and then it'll update this model. And then I'll map a view function over that state, and that's what shows up on screen. So the core components were a model, an update function, and a view function.
And there's the skeleton of the Elm application architecture.
Right. So at this point in time, this would have been like, I guess, 2012 or 13. I had just like noticed that in my own program. So like when I put together the little Mario example, that was one of the like core examples on the website. So you could have Mario walk around and hop. And at that time, I was more okay with code golfing in my examples. For folks who haven't heard that term, it's like how few of characters can you use to express an idea? So I could get that Mario example down to like about 40 lines. And that was like pretty cool, right? So one of the games I had made in high school in Java was like one of these side-scroller things. And like, I can guarantee you it wasn't 40 lines.
Makes sense, yeah.
I mean, in Java, yeah, that wasn't really a viable program length.
Probably the main function was 40 lines.
Yeah. So I would write these little example things and sort of notice, oh, it came out fine. Right, and so I visited, at the time it was called Hacker School, it's now called Recurse Center, and a couple students started doing Elm projects in the week or two that I was there, and one of them did a project that was this old school, like, you know that racing game, the 2D racing game where it's like a path that moves and you have to not hit the walls? So he did a version of that called Vessel, which was like a blood cell going through arteries, I don't know. And so he did that over the course of the weekend. He went from no knowledge of functional programming, let alone, and no, I think no experience with type programming, to creating this game. And it's like quite visually striking. Like he did a really good job. And so at the end he said, hey, do you mind doing a code review? And it just was great. Like it was just all fine. And I had no real feedback, you know, like, the view was neatly separated. The update was pretty straightforward. And so it just felt weird that someone totally new to functional programming in Elm and making games and types would end up with an architecture that was just good.
You mean he didn't even know what a monad was?
Well, yeah. But, like, it just didn't seem right that a week one beginner would do that. And that's, I mean, and it doesn't really matter, like, intelligence level, right? It's just like, why would you think that that would happen in someone's code? So that particular experience was kind of a realization of, okay, there's this pattern that seems to appear in any program you write in Elm, and it's pretty great. And so we went through this sort of trying to understand that pattern more clearly. And it's like, is this a model view controller thing? And ultimately I was like, that term is so vague through like imprecise definitions and different definitions that like basically it's not useful to define yourself in terms of it. But we definitely had a model and we definitely had a view. And my feeling was like, well, controller means all the other stuff. So it's like, yeah, we have a model, we have a view, and then it's like, oh, we have this awful mess of callbacks, and that's our controller. And so, like, anyway, we sort of noticed this pattern, and what this meant was every single Elm application, I thought, should have a certain signal architecture, which was you have a bunch of signals coming in, they get merged into one signal of messages, to use the modern terms. Those get sent to a fold P, which will say, given this message and given this model, what's the new model? And then I map a view function over it, so I go from the model to, at the time it would have been elements, and show that on screen.
So I had kind of assumed that there was prior art here, and that there were a bunch of other projects doing this, and that maybe you got it from a paper, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
No, because we chose a restricted version of signals, basically no other project that got implemented really was comparable. So if you looked at the behavior and event stuff, they were all higher order FRP. So like, instead of having fold P, you'd want to define everything in terms of signals that derived other signals. And so you get a much more complicated like architecture of your code. And the signals would flow all the way through your view code. So like everything was signally. Whereas an element was just like, I have a view function, it goes from ints to graphs, for example.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And similarly, if you looked at the arrowized FRP, it sort of went through the whole code base, and you got these very sort of intense, like one of the papers has a, I think it's a Space Invader style program, or like a, yeah, I think it might be Space Invaders, I don't know, where you shoot the alien battleships. And you get these kind of like self-recursive signals, right? Because I have a ship and it can shoot lasers, and those lasers can hit alien ships, and those alien ships can shoot lasers, and those lasers can hit my ship. So there's this inherent dependency between all of these pieces. And so if you want them all to be signals, well, they all have to be defined in terms of each other. So
that sounds painful.
Well, so yeah, that's what I thought. Not everyone agrees, but that was my feeling, is like, you know, the dream was I can just describe my ship in terms of the simple like physics of its situation. And I think that the dependencies between the values in your program are often a lot subtler than we realize at first. So like to think that the laser of your laser is dependent on the alien laser is like weird, right? But it's certainly true in that if the laser hits you, that's gonna potentially blow you up and you can't send a laser anymore. So like it reveals to you these sort of weird recursive dependencies that like I felt when you put them all together, programs were like insane to read. Like I just couldn't, like I didn't want to have code like that. So point is like there wasn't really prior art because everything was, you know, in heavy quotes, more expressive. But
the problem is when something is more expressive, you express yourself more, and then you're more confusing.
I put it in heavy quotes because it wasn't more expressive. It was the particular abstraction they were interested in could express more. But that doesn't mean that the system is more expressive. It just means that you have what could have been done in lambda calculus, which is like, it's pretty good. Or like the basic of functional programming, like using functions. It could have been expressed that way, but instead we chose to express it with this new abstraction that in some ways competes with this foundational theory of computation that we think is really great. So I kind of saw these more expressive FRP systems as creating an alternative to expressing things in a purely functional way. And I wasn't confident that I was going to beat like the lambda calculus. Like that seems like a pretty serious thing to think about your work. So we sort of noticed that we had this architecture that sort of arose organically, and signals should always look a certain way to make a nice application. And so at some point, you know, fast forwarding a bit, Richard and I went to a lunch where we introduced Elm to some folks. I think Richard was introducing and I was there sort of like in the peanut gallery being like, and this and that kind of thing. And so I guess this would have been post, having an HTML library, and we definitely had that at that point. So, you know, at this point, all the presentations went well until we got to signals. So we'd say, like, hey, here's this view function, and look, I can just put an image and say what the source is, and then I can reuse that image like 4 times, and all of them show up. So, you know, going back in JavaScript times, if you create a DOM node and then use it 4 times, well, or like append it to the DOM 4 times, it will take itself out each time. So you end up with only one. So it's kind of cool where, like, I can actually say, here's a reusable chunk of HTML, and then I can actually reuse it without it disappearing from other places. So that part of the demo went nice. And then we were like, okay, well, what if we, like, hooked it up to a signal and now we can move it around? So that part went nice. But then it was like, okay, well, we need this update function. There's this pattern of signals that we always use. And that part goes less well because you have to say, well, okay, so you need to merge your signals. You need to use foldp. You need to map the... And so you get a lot into the details of signals, but the core, like the essence of the program, wasn't so crazy. So after we were at this lunch, we were walking back to our offices and just talking, like reviewing how it went and saying, you know, one of the cool things that I designed into the system is that it's safe to build up. So the signals in Elm were static graphs, right? So the dependencies were sort of, you could, once your program started, you knew what those dependencies were. But a cool thing was that you could build those dependencies in Elm and still end up with something static in a guaranteed way. And so I was saying, hey, you know, Elm can actually build that signal graph for you. So I bet you, before you get back to your desk, I can write a little library that sets up the signals how you want, and we can just have people write a view function and an update function. And
that was StartApp.
Yeah, exactly. So that was this library called StartApp that was just built on top of signals. And essentially you would say, here are the signals that I care about. Here's my update function. Here's my view function. And it would just set everything up for you. And I think I got it, the baseline working before I got back to his desk. I don't know exactly. I'll have to ask Richard. But it was just like a very simple thing, but it just hadn't occurred to us just because, you know, signals were like, fine. I don't know. Once you got them, it wasn't a problem. But so once we had StartApp, it became clear that this was just like an obviously better way to introduce people to writing these applications. And at some point we started to wonder, like, are signals actually giving us anything that we want now that we have this core? Right, so signals helped us find the architecture that was nice, but once we found that, signals sort of felt like clutter. And so in 0.17, it was sort of a synthesis of, like, there were still things that signals weren't good at. So, like, doing WebSockets with signals was kind of, like, it wasn't going to work out. Because you have this sort of two-directional relationship, which with signals means a signal that depends on another signal. And so essentially you get like a cycle of dependencies if you use signals to do it, and that gets weird. So there were just certain things that I felt it didn't fundamentally match up with. And so 17 was a chance to say, okay, we've noticed that StartApp gives us the expressiveness that we want, and we have these other problems that signals can't really solve, right? So like earlier on we thought HTTP could be done with signals, but HTTP can have this weird branching. So say I... More motorcycles.
It's just giving drama to what you're saying. That's all.
So, you know, say you have a first HTTP request, and depending on the result, you may want to do a different requests later on. Or maybe if something happens, then you do 4 requests, and if another thing happens, you do 2. And that kind of fancy branching structure couldn't really be captured by signals in a nice way, because it had a different mathematical structure. So that ended up manifesting as tasks. And so we were in this world where we had tasks, we had signals, we had mailboxes, we had sort of this hodgepodge of stuff that worked together in a coherent way. I mean, I say hodgepodge because that's how it looked, but like it had this coherent mapping. And so essentially I took the underlying design and sort of ripped out that layer as a public API. So sort of the fundamentals of Elm didn't really change, right? So like if you go back to the thesis work about, I was primarily concerned with concurrency. The fundamentals of how concurrency works in Elm has stayed constant the whole time. And this idea of I have a box that takes inputs and does pure computation inside and gives outputs is sort of the essential model of what an Elm programmer sees. And then sort of you can do cool things on the edges with concurrency and talking from the outputs of the box to the inputs of the box. And so essentially removing signals was removing a API layer where people were getting to a point with Startup where they were saying, you know, I'm using Startup, and at some point I hit this wall where I have to convert everything to the underlying signals to get this or that feature. So we kind of had this impedance mismatch of like not everything fit in signals, not everything fit in Startup. And so 17 was really like an analysis of what actually is necessary for people to use Elm. And when we look at the learning path, like what is the path people are taking and how can we make that ideal, right? And so Startup was just like an obvious win, right? Like we immediately saw more people getting into Elm and like getting it. And you can sort of feel these shifts when you've made a new learning path that works well. Just because like certain kinds of questions just disappear and you find about new questions that you never thought of. So I kind of think of it as like the frontier of confusion frontier. And it's just been like a multi-year process in sort of extending, like moving that frontier back as far as possible. And one thing to note is like that confusion frontier always moves slower than everyone would prefer, but you know, it moves. And that's the nice part.
I'm sure it's difficult to deal with the mini shockwaves of confusion frontier that come with changing the API of the language.
Yeah.
With each version change.
Yeah. I mean, it feels scary whenever you make this kind of change. So even though I had a concept of here is how your signal should be set up, there were people who just like didn't think I was right about how to use signals and would have had much more complicated signal graphs. And so for them, it was a harder transition. But I mean, to me, that was one of the benefits of moving away from signals is like I had a specific intent about how the system should be used. And I was able to capture that intent more precisely with the new abstraction.
Makes sense, yeah.
And so, you'd have people who were sort of more from this school of like, well, everything should be a signal. You should have signals of signals, and they should be dependent on themselves and other things. And so you'd have this frustration of like, well, I can't do that in Elm, but I'm going to try anyway. So you get the ripples of like, when that was removed, that subset of people were like, ah, that's crazy. But I think if you had been sort of engaged with the community at all or like reading resources, it was, from my perspective, hard to argue that you didn't know that's not the recommended way to do things.
Sure. Yeah.
Each time you do this, you do get these ripples. And so one of the things that I now recognize was the way I did that blog post was sort of designed to the actual changes to code that anyone was writing at that time who transitioned from 16 to 17, most of your code didn't change because you had an update function, you had a view function, and that all was pure functions that you could abstract however you want, right? So if you had helper functions, they stayed that way. The only thing was that instead of setting up signals, you set up things slightly different. So your like main, like your start app code would be replaced with something else in 17. So my estimate was like 5% of code would be affected by these changes, assuming you were sort of following the guidelines of the Elm architecture at that time. But I named the blog post like Farewell to FRP, knowing that that was going to be like a spicy title and everyone was going to be like, ooh, what's going on there? Like, and at this time,
it's going to go on HN and people are going to upvote and be angry and
happy.
Well,
and at that time, I think the industry's kind of cooled off on reactive programming overall because it has problems.
There's a design that has problems? Yeah. I don't understand.
Well, but that was kind of the thing is like, you know, hey, we have this new alternative to the Lambda calculus. And it's like, when someone says like there's a new way of computing, like I think you should be skeptical. But there was still like a decent amount of like energy. So it was like timely in that way. And I think in retrospect, like we paid a reputation cost for the views, or for the clicks, right? So like I could have framed it in a more boring way, which was like, you know, that code you don't use, like you don't have to write it anymore, right? Like there were other framings that could have been chosen that would have, like to someone who's skimming and isn't familiar with the ecosystem or what the practical implications of this were, that sounds like a big deal. It's like, I thought Elm was all about FRP and now it's not. And the real situation was, well, the original paper was focused on that. But really the real goal was like, I want to make a reusable sidebar where I can vertically center the logo. So like, to me, it wasn't ever like, oh, FRP. It was more like, I'd like to do a thesis. I'm very interested in this particular project. If I explore FRP in a coherent way, it can be my thesis project, and I want it to be my project for this year anyway. So it was sort of this confluence of things coming together that made it work.
It's not like you were leaving behind the doctrine that started you on this.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that the change was sort of more true to the initial vision, right? Like,
makes sense, yeah.
Like, I fundamentally didn't care about signals. And I think that sort of people sensed that the whole time. So people who were more into FRP were like, how come this person isn't into signals of signals? And it's just like, I don't even like signals that much. Like, because they always had these like little problems that didn't quite, but for example, you want a signal to be defined at all times. So it needs an initial value. The reason for that is when you start a program, you want to know what it looks like on the first frame. You can't wait until the first click to know what the value of the signal is. Because what if someone never clicks? And you need to know the position of the mouse at first, because what if the mouse never moves? But that gets weird when you have like keyboard or... So like what's the first value of keyboard, or what's the first value of window resize, or well, dimensions is straightforward, but like there were just these corner cases where, for example, like if you had HTTP, what's the first value of an HTTP signal of responses?
That's a great example. Yeah, that's a great example.
And so there were these little cases where you just felt a little like, ooh, and one response is like, well, you need signals and you need the evented things, and then you have to figure out how they relate to each other. And I just was like, that seems like such a huge price to pay for these little cases. So I don't know. I sort of felt those corners, even in that like it seemed like the only way to smooth them out was to create something so much more complicated that just like no one would care anymore. Like I wouldn't really be interested in using something as complicated as that. And that was kind of the real judge, was like it didn't seem, it felt like there was a simpler way, and I did, just didn't know what it was. So
actually, I want to make a note there. That's something I started to appreciate, I think, with the 0.18 blog post. Mm. I started to notice with a couple of blog posts you did for that, that I was getting a vibe from you that I'm not used to getting from language creators, which is like, we've done this thing to make your job more practical. Like, the article wasn't about so much all the cool stuff that you did to make the language more awesome. It was like, these changes in the language were made so that you can work better in these ways.
Yeah.
To get your job done. And I was like, not a lot of people talk. I mean, maybe people talk about that all the time, but that's just how I felt. I hadn't really, that it hadn't come to my attention reading other blog posts for other tools a lot, except yours. And I was like, oh, I see why the change was made. It's because he wants me to be successful while I'm making stuff.
Well, and I think you get a, what you get to read about sort of isn't a full sample of language designers. So I think when you, for older languages, those creators are fairly well insulated from writing blog posts. And a lot of them like came up in times when like you didn't write blog posts.
Sure.
So like
maybe you made a post to the mailing list or something.
Maybe, right. But like I got a chance to talk to the creator of C++, and I got to see a talk he did that was all about the history of C++, and I sort of came out of it being like, holy crap, like I so misunderstood the design and motivations of this language and the choices made here. And when it was revealed to me sort of the constraints and the goals, I was like, oh, obviously these are the right choices. And I felt after it really weird, because I felt I was sort of uniquely positioned to see those, and I still didn't. And it took, you know, actually in person seeing this talk to realize all these sort of biases I'd had of like, oh, that's silly. And it's like, okay, but in 1983, was it silly?
And like, great point.
Given the context, it made a lot of sense. And so another factor here was like, a lot of people think, oh, if only it had turned out different. Well, it's not a thought experiment. Like, there were other languages at that time with different designs, and they didn't succeed. And so his design goals were sort of constrained by what he thought was the path to success. And when he lays it out, it's like, oh, like this makes a ton of sense why this was hugely successful, because it was, we want to have people who are using C, their code bases can just be C++. So like, that is a huge constraint on what your language looks like.
Certainly.
And so the point of this is to say, like, I went and asked, you know, hey, how come you never wrote like a blog post about this? Or like, you know, this is a really interesting story for people like me who are sort of on the outside and don't appreciate like how carefully and like brilliantly these choices were made. And he's like, well, I wrote it in my book. So it's just like, just get my book. And it's just like, you know, he never wrote a blog post for C++. So someone asked, like, how did this language take off? And it was like, well, there was an industry conference and people would sign up. They'd put their mailing address on this piece of paper and we'd mail them like the floppy disks of the compiler. And the cost was like the cost of the floppy disk, not, so it was like essentially free. At that time, that was like crazy. No, you couldn't do that with other compilers. And it just from there sort of snowballed. And like, that's a story that like, for many, many reasons, like could never happen anymore. But point is like a lot of the folks who have these kinds of, like, I think most language designers do have this, like, I want it to be nice to use this thing. And especially with like modern designers, like if you talk to the Julia people, for example, it's very much like, how do I make the life of a scientist like great when it comes to scientific computing? But you have this other layer of people who are interested in programming language stuff, which is, you know, they're interested in programming languages, which is in some sense a different subfield. because there's all these things that are interesting about like types and evaluation and concurrency, all these sort of topics that are really, really interesting in their own, on their own. And so, yeah, but I think of the, I will defend the language designers I've met, that it's often putting these together for the sake of the user. So it's both the interest in program languages, but also an interest in things being nice. And often you don't hear that because being interested in program languages is something that people blog about in a sort of hobbyist way quite a lot.
Well, that's great to know. I mean, I'm glad that you do it publicly as maybe like a designed approach to the users of the community to help them to understand and get on board with the direction it's going.
Yeah.
And why.
Well, and my hope is that like with a lot of language design stuff, I think it's easy to look at it and say, oh, that's interesting, therefore it's valuable. And I think that's like a low standard of judging language work, which is like, it's interesting, but the next question is like, what does it do to your code? What does it take to learn that? What does it take for someone with no background in this concept to learn that? And all of these, I think, I will tie into the value of that particular idea. And just that it's interesting and useful in this certain way on its own isn't enough. And so one of my hopes in sort of outlining the thinking on these features is like that I can convey that higher standard of evaluation and sort of get people to like buy into that way of looking at things.
Well, that's pretty compelling. There's an analogy, I think, maybe to be made there between the car industry and this industry, which is, if you've ever seen drawings of concept cars, they look amazing. Like, there's these just mind-blowingly interesting concept car illustrations that I would look at years ago and just die for and say, why don't they just make that car? It's right there. Like, why can't they just make it?
Right.
But there's a reason concept cars aren't mass marketed, and that's because it's exploration, and what's interesting isn't always what's practical or valuable even. And I think the same thing happens here. There are concept languages. There are concepts which are quite interesting, which in practicality don't necessarily prove to be safe or prove to be practical.
Or they like, I like this car analogy, where it's like, that is actually great, but we need the material science advancement to like really make it practical. So like,
yeah,
there's some other piece there that's not filled in, and that may be like, what's the learning route? Like, what's the presentation of this concept that makes it look like a boring old car?
Yeah, right.
So that's definitely something that, you know, for example, when I was doing 17, I was reading a bunch of papers about effect systems. So for people who are interested in this kind of stuff, there's this language called COCA by Dan Lyon wrote this great paper on extensible records, which actually is the foundation of the record system in Elm. And I really enjoy both his writing and his work and his ideas. But COCA is one of these effect systems that's exploring how do we describe interaction in a way that can still be like purely functional. So I would explore this whole sort of developing field of research and sort of try to come back and say, okay, what is the simple piece, or like, how can I reflect this down to the simplest possible version that does what we need it to do? And I think that's cool also because it means that the current design has an eye towards potential future advances in programming languages. So like, I try to keep an eye on all the things that are developing. So like the other day, there was a really neat blog post about linear types in Haskell. And this is a way of doing like resource management. So I can say, if I give you this, you definitely have to respond to me back. And so it can enforce these certain rules. And that's very interesting. And so like, I like to keep an eye on that. But ultimately the bar has to be like, this is like fun and easy to use before I'm confident like going for it, which is like, a separate question that people may or may not find interesting, depending on their, you know, preferences.
I think my interpretation, partly of what you just said too, is that the simpler that you keep the language now, the more flexible you are to adopt great ideas in the future as they come along.
Yeah, and
you don't get mired.
Yeah. So, and I want to be really picky with the with those particular things, because you know we have historical data on what it looks like to grow a language, and so like adding one feature a year in 20 years is like a lot. Adding one every 5, it still maybe takes you away from that core concept that made the language like beautiful. And so there, I think there is this tension between like adding a bunch of stuff and keeping the essence and beauty of the core idea.
I could wax philosophical about that tension in every, in many other parts of life. I'll spare you the philosophy, though. That was a great conversation, and we ran quite a while. Oh. So let's wrap up.
Okay, cool.
It's not a problem. It was fantastic. Let's wrap up with some picks. I have one pick. Do you have any picks, Adam?
I have one with sub picks. It's a pick with sub picks.
Whoa, that's cool.
So there's this album called Let's Get Free by Dead Prez. And if you want to just sample some songs, I'd say the song Hip Hop. It's very interesting. There's another one called Eat Healthy.
Okay.
And then there's one that I think is important. Like, I think this whole album's actually like an important one called Wolves. But yeah, so it's this group that they self-identify as socialists, and I think it's rare that you get to hear such a combination of perspectives that are compelling and like fun to listen to, and in some ways like tragic in that like this album's like from around 2000, and it's just like, oh, the same problems that are so sort of like passionately outlined here are still problems. Anyway,
is Wolves one of their albums?
Let's Get Free is the album.
And then Wolves is one of the songs.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, that is quite interesting. I love music that says more than just let's party. I like to hear what people have to say musically. Not that partying music is always terrible. I don't want to throw out the party.
Well, if there's a party, it's just going to be quiet. It's crazy.
Sorry. That would be a pretty funny party, though. If it just had the lights and you came in and everyone's jumping around and there's no music. Yeah. In fact, that might be kind of nice. I might be able to relax a little bit at that point.
I think this is a perversion of the essence of a party.
Oh, okay.
I think you're talking about maybe like a dinner party now.
Oh, I happen to be, I guess, a dinner party guy maybe, instead of a rave guy. I'm surprised. So my one pick is something I picked before, but I'm picking it again because it's so good, and that's Chris Jenkins' Remote Data Library, or package, not library, package. And I have found myself using it all the time. Almost in every project that I start, I've used it for rendering UIs or for keeping, just anytime I need to keep data that I don't have right now and that I'm going to have in the future, I use that library, and it's fantastic. Gives me everything I need. So just going to drop that little plug in there. If you don't use it and you don't know why, I think Chris actually has a blog post on it. Yeah, he does. So I'll link that blog post too, about how Elm slays a UI anti-pattern, and he links to his library in there. But it's about representing data that you don't yet have with the type system. And it's a really powerful concept. Because it's more, once again, encoding your expectations in the type system and letting the compiler take that load off. It's pretty fantastic. Have you used that at all, Evan?
Yeah, I've checked it out. It's I describe it as often people want to use maybe for everything, but sometimes things are more specific than either not there or there. And this is one of these cases where maybe you're waiting, maybe you have partial data, maybe you have an error, and it sort of exactly captures the situation in a way that's just like, that's kind of the beauty of union types, is you can really exactly define what's going to happen in your program. And when you get that core understanding right, like the rest of your program just like works better somehow.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's a cool realization.
And it comes with all the same tools you expect from maybe in the other data structures like and then and map and map two and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of good stuff you can do there. I find myself making my view functions expecting to use the data as if it were already there. And then I can wrap up my view function also in a remote data container. And then I just combine all of those remote data together. Is that a bad thing?
I don't know. I'd have to see it, but that's a little intense.
It's worked really, really well for me because then my view function stays super simple. And then on the outside, I just say, hey, this whole view isn't going to render unless I've got all the data I need for
it. Does that mean you're just saying it's just mapping it over the remote data structure?
It basically, if I were doing it in Haskell, it would be an applicative functor where I just like lift the view function into the remote data. And then I do an and map with the arguments it needs. And then I get a remote data of HTML. Sure. And it works out pretty nice.
Another way to say it would be like using a map 2 or map 3, where the view function is the function. But you could say it either way too.
Right. In fact, there was something I did the other day. I think it was task where it didn't have and map, but I implemented it with.
And then.
I like that. Oh, yeah, sorry. And.
Or map 2.
I thought it was and map, but.
Well, no, I'm saying sure you can implement it in terms of map 2 or and then. So.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I ended up doing was I used map 2. Yeah. And I just, that's not necessarily a pattern everyone should use, but I'm comfortable with it. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Sorry I dragged it on even longer.
No worries.
Okay, Evan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Okay.
Bye.